This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, the host. Glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be looking back to the origins of Social Security here in the United States and how this program was created and what the people who created it were thinking that they were doing with the creation of Social Security. If you go back and take a look at the Act, when it was signed into law in 1935, you look particularly at those parts that we think of now when we think of Social Security, that is unemployment insurance and benefits to retirees, there were a lot of people who weren't covered by Social Security. Most of these people were farm workers, also people who were self-employed, and in fact, anyone who worked for an employer who had less than 10 workers. All of that added up was about half of the labor force in the United States not covered. And this was particularly true of African Americans. In effect, these exclusions meant that most African Americans, certainly African Americans in the southern parts of the United States, were not included. They were not eligible for these benefits under Social Security. And when you ask why is that the case, the conventional explanation, at least recently by historians, has been that that exclusion of African Americans was deliberate and it was done to satisfy members of Congress from the South who wanted that to happen. It was they were cut out deliberately so that Southern members essentially would sign on. Our guest this morning says that that's really not quite the way that it was, that in fact it's much more complicated. And the ways that people thought at the time about these issues not only are significant, were significant then, but are still significant. And for a long time here, going back from that time to this, has a lot to do with the way that we think about social welfare policy here in the United States. Our guest is Mary Poole. She teaches history at Prescott College, which is in Prescott, Arizona, and she is the author of a book that's titled The Segregated Origins of Social Security, the subtitle African Americans and the Welfare State. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, people have questions, comments, they can certainly give us a call. Ms. Poole, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Great. I'm doing great.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just to start off with, and I think what I know of this history certainly reflects that viewpoint, that the one that I just gave, that is that sort of this conventional explanation about how it is that initially the system was structured, and particularly how it is that agricultural workers and people who are self-employed were excluded, and the fact that a lot of those people were African Americans. Why did all that happen? Well, the explanation, at least the one that I had always read, was this was the price to get it passed for the members of Congress from the South. They wanted those people excluded to get their support. The Roosevelt administration said fine. As I say, you say, well, no, there's really a lot more to it than that. And in fact, the kind of exclusions we're talking about were really built into the program by not by Southern congressmen, but by Midwesterners, actually, who worked to make policy, who formed this policy for the administration. But saving that for a second, let's just talk a little bit about what attitudes were toward what was proposed here, toward the proposals of Social Security, and maybe in a larger sense toward the New Deal. What were the attitudes of Southern members of Congress?
There was a lot of good reason to think that Southern members of Congress would have been responsible for the exclusion of African Americans. And in fact, I went into the research assuming that myself, and it took me banging my head against the archives for a long time before I accepted what I was seeing. Southerners, first of all, were very powerful in Congress in the 1930s. They controlled both houses of Congress and the fiscal committees. And so nothing much was done without their support. And they also had a long history of of passing legislation in southern states, of course, that limited the rights of African Americans there. And the other thing was that they were known to unify around issues of anti-lynching legislation. And so they actually filibustered to prevent anti-lynching legislation from being considered in Congress, and held up one bill for 8 days. So there's a lot in the historical record that suggests that they would have a problem with African Americans being covered by Social Security and would unify against that. But that's simply not what I found, and it challenges, I think, the way that I've come to see how social policy is made discriminatory. So the way it happened was that Roosevelt's people were brought in from Wisconsin, and they were labor reformers and were people that were dedicated for decades to improving the conditions and the bargaining power of industrial labor. They were students of John Commons, and he was heavily involved behind the scenes in developing the act. And they came to Washington because they had created an unemployment insurance program in Wisconsin, and it was not being enacted because of the fear of businesses in Wisconsin that it would undermine them in relation to other states. It would cause them to have to raise their prices to cover the cost of unemployment insurance. So they came to Washington with a very specific agenda to create this program, and they actually were responsible for the big means through which African Americans were discriminated against. The main way that African Americans were discriminated against in the Social Security Act was that the Wisconsin reformers insisted that our welfare system be structured around two separate tiers. European and other systems, there were some 60 countries around the world in Latin America and Europe and other places that had social welfare systems at this point. So we were behind the ball in the development of our system. But most other systems had unified approaches, which meant that people that were out of work or in need for whatever set of reasons would be covered through the same program and covered relatively equally. And so it wasn't an issue in Europe whether farm workers and domestic workers were included in the same way. They created one program. But in America, we developed a two-tiered approach that was based around the need to have a separate unemployment insurance program. So what we created, what the Wisconsin reformers working for President Roosevelt created, was a tier of insurance programs, which were unemployment insurance and Social Security, those two, and then a separate tier, a lower tier of welfare programs. And the two tiers were made to be distinguished completely from each other. Their great fear at the time, the fear across the nation, actually, everybody in America at this time was afraid of economic dependence. Unemployment rates were through the roof, and middle-class people had lost their jobs for the first time, and men in particular, there was a lot of concern that men would lose their character and their independence if they were made dependent on a welfare kind of a program. And so Roosevelt's team created a program to salvage white male industrial workers from that fate and put them into this top tier, and excluded pretty much everybody else, women workers and African-American men, from that tier, and created the bottom tier to be the opposite of that top tier. So they actually created a welfare system that would create dependence, where people would be, a system that would be stigmatized, where people would be required to prove that they were poor in order to get assistance, not just that they had lost their job. They had to be willing to take work outside of their field or for less money. This was put forth in memos very clearly that these two tiers would be created and that they would be unequal to each other. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main impact. And so African Americans were excluded from that top tier because they were excluded from the industrial workforce and excluded from the unions that enabled those jobs. And then there was another specific exclusion of agricultural and domestic workers. They were thought to be too difficult to administer, although that turned out to actually not be the case later on. But they were specifically excluded, and again, this was driven by Roosevelt's own people.
Yeah. Well, that gets, again, another one of these justifications for one of the things that you read, justifications for why particularly those kinds of workers were excluded. The explanation has been that the systems were designed to be funded by workers. That is, people paid a tax,
right,
in effect, from their paychecks to support these systems from which later they would draw benefits. And some people made the argument and said, well, if you talk about farm workers, they're maybe difficult. They move around. They're difficult to find. They don't work in the same sort of regulated way. They're not paid in the same sort of regulated way. Those kinds of people who work for very small businesses, people who are self-employed, domestic workers, and so forth. The argument was, well, how are we going to collect payroll taxes from these people? It's just too much trouble. We can't do it. So for that reason, we're just not going to do it.
Right. Actually, it's interesting because that was an argument made at the time. Employee contributions was a very critical feature of this plan, and it only applied, of course, to the top-tier programs. The idea was that if employees paid into their own insurance, then they would not feel like they were getting welfare. And so that was one of the main distinctions between the tiers. However, there's a misconception that's built into that. The bottom-tier programs, the welfare programs, are paid, of course, through by the taxpayers out of the general fund. But the top tier also was paid for by the public because the assumption was built in that industries, in order to make contributions on behalf of their employees, would have to raise prices. That's the reason why the program had to be national, so all industries throughout the nation would raise prices together. So the impact of this top tier actually had the effect of moving wealth from poor rural southern states to northern industrial states, because the industrial states were favored because industrial workers were favored in this plan. So the employee contributions, actually, it's kind of a little bit of a smoke and mirrors. It looks on the surface like it's an insurance program, but the same people are paying for both types of welfare. Hmm.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation.
Sure.
And let me again introduce the guest, Mary Poole. She teaches history at Prescott College in Prescott, Arizona. She also has in the past served as analyst with the Washington State Senate, where she drafted the budget for state and federal welfare programs. And she's the author of a book that's titled The Segregated Origins of Social Security, African Americans and the Welfare State. It is published by the University of North Carolina Press, which takes a look, as she has explained, at how it is that Social Security was conceived and why it is that certain people were included and certain people not. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, something like half of the American workforce was not eligible for Social Security. They were not included in the program, or at least if you look at those things that we think of when we think of Social Security, unemployment insurance and the benefit to the old age pension benefit. Generally speaking, it was people who were industrial workers who worked for big companies who were included, and farm workers and people who were self-employed and people who worked for small employers who had fewer than 10 workers. None of those people were covered by Social Security. Questions are welcome here. We have a couple of people ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Here in Champaign-Urbana to start with, line one. Hello.
I discussed the retirement age. Like, did they have a committee carefully look into it? Because once a source said that they looked at Europe and said 60 was too young, 70 was too old, so they just compromised. But, like, did they actually do some surveys and so forth? And second, what happened to those people who were excluded from this system, as you say? Did they eventually basically retire to county homes and so forth?
Hi. On your first question, the age of recipients was not a very controversial issue back in 1935, simply because Americans were so interested in getting some kind of a pension put into place. And so there were so many pieces to debate that that wasn't one that that loomed large. A lot of amendments have been made to the Social Security Act since then, so a lot of changes have been made to things like age. Your second question, I'm sorry, can you repeat your second
question? Well, the second question would be for those people that we're talking about that were not eligible for the pension benefit, when those people died, and particularly if they didn't have money, if they couldn't support themselves, what happened to them? Was there any kind of a safety net for those
people? Right. Yes, thank you. There was a second-tier, bottom-tier program created called Old Age Assistance. So there were two programs created in the Social Security Act for people when they retired. But unlike Social Security, the Old Age Assistance program was not automatic. You only received it if you were completely indigent, and so that means you couldn't own things like a house. And you had to prove that you were poor. And the benefits through that program were so small. They were $4, $10 a month, you know, in that range. Also, the state had to have a program to match the federal funds for that. So if your state didn't have a program, then you didn't get benefits. And it took a while for poorer states to develop that locally. The state had to have an infrastructure to pay the bill, you know, to pay the benefits. And so most people did not benefit, and certainly most African Americans did not benefit from that program in any tangible way. So it was created, but it wasn't very effective for a long time.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Charleston. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Thanks again, David. My two questions. The first, and I'll hang on for answers,
okay,
is that what the discussion today is about is principally the failures of capitalism. And the second question comment would be, I'm an older man now, and I listened to my parents and all, and then the word around was that Franklin Roosevelt depleted the Social Security Fund to help finance World War II. Now, are those things, I think the first, you know, that capitalism is what it is, and trying to survive, it's going to do whatever it takes, so long as they have power. But the other question about Roosevelt, I have not researched that. So.
Yeah. Well, I'll respond to the first question first. The whole debate about Social Security had everything to do with capitalism, because when the economy collapsed with the Depression, there was a lot of public discourse, as you, it sounds like you know, about what the best economic system would be for the country. And so the other proposals that were made for different social welfare systems were actually all of them more radical than the Social Security Act, more socialist in their nature. And they, none of them, by the way, discriminated against African Americans or against any group. And they were promoted by groups, not just groups that were critical of capitalism per se, but groups that were questioning whether our form of capitalism was working. So that was a factor. The system that we got was an attempt to salvage capitalism. You know, as I said a minute ago, that was its prime purpose. And your second question, I'm sorry. Oh, about the reserves. I had actually not heard that. The what I know about the reserves is that it created a tremendous problem for our economy to have to set aside the amount of money that was required. When you pay into Social Security, it goes into the federal government, and then it pulls that money out of the economy. And by 1937, there was a great deal of fear that it was that actually Social Security was having a negative impact on the economy. And the welfare state programs like old age assistance, and also the program that evolved into aid to families with dependent children, our main federal welfare program, Those programs were created in part to alleviate the problem of the money having been pulled out of the economy to put into Social Security reserves. I hadn't heard that about World War II, but...
And some of that extant today with Mr. Bush's efforts to destroy Social Security as we know it, and then all the money that is still in there, as far as I know, but the borrowing. I listened to this program once before, a man from the U of I, a professor, mentioning about the Social Security fund and that it was supposed to be there and but was depleted at times and borrowed or IOUs put into the Treasury in lieu of actual money.
Uh-huh.
And do you know anything about that?
Well, I know that the history actually has a lot of information for us about the current debate about privatization. And the main point that I pull out of the history is that we built our social welfare system on a basis that was tied very closely to the private economy, to the private sector. In many ways, our social welfare system reflects the inequalities that were already existing in the employment market, for example. And so it assumed, those kind of the systems. When you tie a government social welfare program to the private sector, you have to assume that there's already an even playing field. And there isn't. There wasn't in 1935, and there isn't today. And so so that's one of the main learnings, I think, out of the history is that government has tremendous power through social welfare. I'm convinced, after doing this research, that it has tremendous power to affect social change and to affect either to promote and even produce inequality in a society or to actually undermine inequality. And that's true in countless ways from the movement of wealth from one community to another, from one region of the country to another, from one class or sector of society to another, but also in our perception of what causes poverty and is it hopeless, is racial equality a possibility in America? I think that the welfare system that we developed actually has affected us in our perception of what is possible and of why people are poor and who are poor people, what it means to be unemployed, all of that. And so, basically it's tying it to the private sector. The government can either challenge the inequality that's existing in the private sector through its social welfare system, or it can further that inequality.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
We are certainly open to other callers. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Mary Poole. She teaches history at Prescott College in Prescott, Arizona, and is the author of the book The Segregated Origins of Social Security, the subtitle African Americans and the Welfare State. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. Just sort of to underline the last point you make, I think one of the strong arguments you make in the book is that going back here to the origins of these programs where you, as you explained, here in the United States, we had a two-tier system, unlike what existed in most other countries. So we had one tier that where we had unemployment insurance and the pension benefits that was tied to or created to support industrial workers, generally male and white. And then we had another tier of welfare programs that had, for example, the program, as you say, that came to be called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, and now it's called something else again. After welfare reform.
Right.
What happened, in effect, we encouraged people to think about, if you think about people who are maybe need government assistance, we encouraged people to think about there were people that were deserving and that there were people that were not.
Right.
And that there were these two different groups and that somehow they were more worthy of assistance. Some were more worthy than others, and that really carries through all the way to the present, the way that we think about what sort of responsibility does government have, or should government have some kind of responsibility to help help disadvantaged citizens.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to wrap your mind around it from our vantage point today, because when something gets put in place, and then it becomes what's real and what we all expect. So we expect to have a welfare system and then also to have Social Security and unemployment insurance. But if you go back to 1934, before the act was created, what you had was massive anxiety and confusion of Americans, and fear about the future and a desire for some kind of safety net. But these categories had not yet been created, and so people were not operating out of them. All Americans wanted work. That was the consensus. When you read through the letters that were sent to President Roosevelt from people across the spectrum, from all job categories, people were saying, "Please help me by giving me a job." And it was said over and over again, "Don't give me, I don't want a handout. I want work. I want to provide for my family." And so what the act did was take that unified group, that one voice, and split it down the middle and assigned a part of America, a big group of American citizens, to dependents. It assigned them that it was their social assignment. And, now we live in a day when, our society points a finger at welfare and at a culture of welfare, and we have volumes that have been written on social pathology of welfare, and that work was already starting in 1936. There were articles beginning to be published for the first time about how people on welfare didn't want to work, and they were becoming a burden on society. And so I think that the history, one thing it does for me is that it helps me remove myself into a time when people saw the world differently, and it helps to open up possibilities for how we can see the world differently today. Because the relationship between race and welfare that Americans recognize exists. We might have different opinions about the nature of that relationship, but I think we all recognize that there is a relationship. That relationship was created relatively recently in history, which suggests that we can undo it also. Mm-hmm.
Let's take another caller. And do we have somebody over in Indiana who would like to join us? Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. The last few minutes you've been talking is sort of about the question I've asked, and it was brought up by your statement that they wanted to make sure white men didn't lose, faith in themselves because they needed employment to keep their manhood. In a real general sense, this seems to be quite different from the position of the Europeans in how they did their welfare compared to ours. I was wondering if you were able to check, in a sense, the philosophical underpinnings of this position. Where I sure remember as a kid, my grandfather was coming right up during the height of the Depression, and he still was humiliated to talk about it as though there was something wrong with him because he couldn't find a job, even though there weren't any jobs. I always thought that was some strange character flaw in American personality. I just wonder if you could talk about that in any way whatsoever. Thanks a lot.
Right, sure. Your grandfather was not at all alone. I think that was a very shared experience. The one thing that's not known is that Americans in the 1930s had organized clubs all over the country. The Townsend movement was the Townsend clubs were the biggest, the most widespread, the biggest organization. But there were many of them, and it's possible that up to 20 million people in America, so that would be like a sixth of the population, was involved in these organizations. And the organizations demanded that. That all Americans who had lived to retirement age had helped to build the wealth of the country and deserved a pension. And that's a much more of the European perspective that you're referring to on what the purpose of social welfare is. And most Americans appear to have been in agreement with that position, that citizenship is the basis of your right to social welfare, not the amount of your previous earnings or your foresight in setting money aside. So we had a grassroots movement in this country that was stating a very different philosophical perspective on social welfare than the one we ended up with.
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting point, and one that I was going to raise, and that is, as you write in the book, and I'm sure a lot of people think, that we now tend to see Social Security as the embodiment of liberal social policy. I'm sure that there are some people who still think that the New Deal was one of the most radical things ever enacted in the history of the United States.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that, depending upon how you viewed them, there were other proposals that were either truly more radical or one might also say more progressive possibilities that were not enacted, and the Townsend idea was one of them, and there was another, so that there was indeed some discussion about how it is we're going to do this, and the ideas were definitely different from what we ended up with.
Yeah, there was the Townsend movement wanted to put a 2% tax on all financial transactions all over the board. And everybody acknowledged that the effect of this would be to redistribute wealth. And that was their plan. It was very simplistic, probably not workable, but it expressed a belief that wealth should be shared. There was the Share the Wealth movement that was initiated by Huey Long, who was a senator from Louisiana. So there was just so much public discourse at this moment about how to fairly and equitably create safety nets, care for citizens, distribute wealth. You know, it would have been a pretty exciting time to be a policymaker, I think. And your other point about the understanding that the New Deal was liberal, and I think that the New Deal programs spanned such a spectrum of some of them were extremely radical. Some of the agricultural initiatives that were taken under President Roosevelt were very radical in a sense. The Social Security Act is probably one of the more conservative policies that came out of the New Deal.
Let's talk with someone else here calling out here locally, where we are in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I think back in terms of the grandparents and actually my parents, sort of the stigma that even taking unemployment, you know, some people, you know, in terms of how they viewed being on unemployment, especially for the short time or something or other, that, you know, they just didn't want to do that. I wonder how many people didn't. I mean, this is after the Depression, you know,
right.
Years and years later, where all of a sudden there was a feeling, well, gee, you know, it wouldn't be right to take this or something or other, or the stigma attached with it. Did you find anything in that regard or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's true for my grandparents, too. And there was tremendous resistance by the American public to the plan that was adopted. And what Americans wanted, what they said over and over again, was they wanted something that was equally distributed and, you know, if it went to everybody, then there would be no stigma attached. And in fact, in Texas, I believe it was, Texas as a state refused to participate. They wanted to, after the Social Security Act, they eventually went along with it. But initially, they wanted to create, instead of old age assistance, they wanted to create pensions that would be equally given to everybody. Instead of a means-tested program. But the Social Security Board went to great lengths to convince Americans that Social Security and unemployment insurance would not be welfare programs, because most Americans felt the way that your grandparents felt. They didn't want those, you know, they didn't want what they considered to be charity. And so there was actually an ad campaign, and you see pictures I think I have one of them in the book. There's a picture of a man who is, you know, 65 or older, and he's got his thumbs looped through his suspenders, and he looks like he's crowing, and he's, you know, it's an ad for Social Security saying you can get Social Security and you can still feel proud of yourself. So they went to great lengths to convince people, and it wasn't an easy job.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, other questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Certainly in the conversation about what should be done to try to benefit all Americans, African-Americans particularly, there were organizations that represented the interest of African-Americans that at the time, the NAACP existed, the Urban League existed, and others. Did they try to weigh in on this debate and to say to the Roosevelt administration, look, what you're doing is fine, but it's really leaving out an awful lot of Americans, Black Americans in particular?
Yes, absolutely. There were three organizations that were working in Washington at that time, and they all weighed in. The one that was most potentially effective was the Joint Committee on National Recovery. That was an organization begun by Ralph Bunche and others to specifically look at discrimination and New Deal programs. But it was underfunded, as all the Black organizations were. It had extremely tight budget and many, many things to cover. In spite of that, the Joint Committee focused on the Social Security Act for a big chunk of its, you know, time in 1935. The chair of that board, George Edmund Haynes, made a brilliant analysis of the act, and right, you know, when it was first introduced by Roosevelt's people, nobody was talking about the act as discriminatory yet. But he saw it immediately, and he testified before both the House and Senate, and actually gave the lawmakers a blueprint for how to make the act, you know, serve equally. Different provisions that could be put into the act to ensure equal distribution of the funds to different parts of states and different states, and so his analysis was amazing, and it still could be useful to us. He drew a lot on the history of discrimination in America and places where federal policy has been discriminatory and where it has not been discriminatory. But he was pretty much excluded from the process, as all the Black organizations were. They just simply did not have the relationships built. They tried and tried. You know, it wasn't for lack of effort, but they did not. They weren't insiders in the process. So the NAACP had an in with Eleanor Roosevelt, and they worked that in every direction that they could. But the bottom line is that white policymakers were ultimately not open to being criticized about discrimination in the policy that they were creating. And so these Black organizations were on safe ground when they criticized Southern states and Southern members of Congress for discrimination. But they lost their friends immediately when they criticized the New Deal. And so they knew that, and they kept themselves, you know, at a safe distance.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I remember during the 80s when the welfare mother first began really coming to the fore in the media, and this was generally characterized as someone who was Black and lived in our urban area, but it seems that the truth at that time was that the majority of welfare recipients were white and lived in rural areas. I was wondering if you knew whether that was still true.
Yes, it's always been true, and in fact, the what I know about most is Washington State, because that's where I worked on welfare policy as an analyst. And the perception, what I noticed, actually, one of the reasons that I got into this research was that I noticed a gap between the way welfare is talked about by policymakers and then the people that are actually receiving welfare. The debates in the 80s, a lot of them had to do, this was leading up to the welfare reform that happened under Clinton administration. The debates in the 80s had to do with a lot of fear about welfare, people on welfare taking advantage of the system, cheating, you know, how to prevent that, how to prevent people from having a second child in order to gain more in benefits, which you know, the benefits that are in addition in Washington at that time was, I think, something like $23 a month. You know, it was an absurdly small amount of money. But policymakers were actually talking like this and debating these concerns, and it occurred to me that they were talking about people on welfare as if they were a kind of an alien life form, you know, that they weren't making their decisions and approaching economic strategies in the same way that policymakers were, you know, approaching their own decisions. And so what I found out looking into the issue is that the majority of people on welfare in Washington were people that lived in their own communities, you know, that they'd grown up in. They were a part of their communities. And the majority of them were, you know, categorized as white, and they were mostly a young woman with one child was the kind of the typical person on welfare. And so I think that that gap is really destructive. The mentality that we carry very much affects how policy is created, and it doesn't, in all cases, meet the needs of the people that are actually receiving welfare.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, again, questions, other questions are certainly welcome. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour with our guest, Mary Poole from Prescott College in Arizona. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, under this vast, this big umbrella of the Social Security Act of 1935, there were a number of programs. There were the programs we've talked about for the pension benefit, for unemployment insurance, and there were also programs that were aimed at helping other people who were disadvantaged. One of these is the program that came to be called it was originally Aid to Dependent Children,
yes.
And then it was Aid to Families with Dependent Children, and
now it's Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunities.
It's yes, we like to have difficult titles for things, and it was again as part of what we call welfare reform. The name of the program was changed again. How at the time, how were people thinking, particularly about the needs of women and children, and how they should be provided for?
Well, that's actually one of the most interesting stories that come out of the Social Security Act, because the women and children had been provided for in some places by state mothers' pension programs. And then through the Social Security Act, the reformers that were located in the Children's Bureau, which was a group of women reformers who'd been fighting for the rights of mothers and children for a couple decades, they saw this as an opportunity to get a national mothers' pension program created. And they put a lot of work and energy into that. But they were ultimately undermined in their attempt, and we came up with a welfare program for mothers and children out of the Social Security Act rather than a pension program, which they had wanted. The reason for that goes back to the two-tiered system, that once the two tiers were created, policymakers in Washington who had a vested interest in a particular constituency did their best to get their group in the favored top tier category, and so the reformers in the Children's Bureau worked to get women and children in their own program that would be separate from unemployed men, for example, long-term unemployed men. The director, though, of the program for unemployed men fought and ultimately won, but he fought to get women and children pulled into his program to try to elevate the status of the unemployment program. So a separate program was created for women and children, but it was housed, it was created by the emergency relief program, and it was housed with that program. And so it took on the stigma of welfare rather than being granted the recognition of a pension program. So do you see what I mean? It, mm-hmm. it was all a scramble to see who could get what group on which side of the line. So women and children came out of the Social Security Act in a welfare program that was stigmatized, that was means-tested, that provided very little funding. And it was the women that created the program, that, or that tried to create a different program, grieved over that loss.
It just it makes you think about, and I'm sure this is true of how policy is made, is that policy it's not always intentional, or at least bureaucratic infighting, and different interested parties struggling to represent the interests of the people that they represent. That's we don't always end up with the programs we have because someone sat down and decided this is the way it's going to be, and we're going to draw it out like this, and this is the way it's going to be structured. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's one thing I learned, is that there are so many different perspectives when policymakers sit down to create policy. And what's really crucial, I think, because no one sees the whole picture. They mostly see what's good for the group that they represent or have an affinity with. And I think what's most important is that you have people sitting around the table who do not currently benefit from existing structures of power.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have diversity. You have to have diverse policymakers, because otherwise you're going to have, the policy that you come out with is going to be slanted. And in 1935, there was nobody around the table who was advocating for African Americans, which is why they lost out to the greatest degree.
Yeah. Well, there, and just coming to sort of wrap up here, we have a couple of minutes left. Coming back to the basic point of the book, that is indeed the basic question that you pose is, well, how is it that in fact, when the Social Security Act was created, came into law in 1935, that in fact, African Americans were discriminated against? They were not treated the same way as white workers were. And that you cannot explain this, or you cannot explain this through conscious racism. That is, it was not a deliberate
right.
attempt by anybody, Southern members of Congress or policymakers or anybody else,
right.
to discriminate against African Americans. But in effect, that's what happened, perhaps in part because of the approach that was focusing on white male industrial workers, and also, as you say, because African Americans just weren't at the table.
Right.
They really didn't have a very strong voice. So by going back and looking at this and learning about looking a little bit more closely at how it is that this happened, what did we learn? I mean, what's the important lesson to be taken away, do you think?
I think that one really important lesson is that we need to step back and really look again at the notion that I think we approach this subject with. We think that public policy is made discriminatory because liberal and conservative policymakers battle it out, and then when the liberal policymakers lose, discriminatory policy can be created. And, we definitely approach the New Deal this way, thinking that that the whole story is a fight between Southerners and Congress and, Roosevelt's people. And I think what happens when we get locked into that perspective is that we get stuck, because there's no real way out of that perspective. That's an endless fight, You've created a fight that's eternal and not solvable. And what I found in my research is that that's not actually the way that the Social Security Act was made discriminatory. And it's so I think we have to look at how at what policymakers share in terms of their interest and perspective, and that's a means to actually to resolve racial inequality through public policy. So I don't see my coming out of this research, I feel very hopeful about what can be done in public policy to eradicate racial inequality. But I think we have to be thinking about the question differently.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. And again, if people would like to read in closer detail the history that we've talked about here, the book you should look for is The Segregated Origins of Social Security, African Americans and the Welfare State, published by the University of North Carolina Press by our guest, Mary Poole. She teaches history at Prescott College in Prescott, Arizona. And Dr. Poole, we want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.